You connect with patients, you spend time clinical reasoning, and you get to a diagnosis. What matters next is that your patients actually start their medications. Amazon Pharmacy is built to close that gap. Same-day prescription delivery across the country. Transparent pricing so patients don't abandon scripts at the counter. Real-time benefit checks integrated into your EHR. And 24/7 licensed pharmacists backing you up on the other side. Your diagnosis, your patient's doorstep. Visit pharmacy.amazon.com/prescribers.
Welcome back, clinical problem solvers. Maddie and Yusuf here. At CP Solvers, our mission is to make clinical reasoning accessible to learners worldwide. We invite you to join us for our live virtual morning reports, where we break down cases and sharpen our diagnostic reasoning together. Now over to you, Yusuf.
Thanks, Maddie. Just a quick reminder, this podcast is for educational purposes only and is not a substitute for medical advice. Patient details have been modified to protect their privacy, and the views expressed here are our own, not those of our employers. Now, let's dive into the case.
Enjoy the show! Welcome back, clinical problem solvers, to another schema episode. I'm here with the schema team and my friends Yusuf, Mark, and Noah. So excited to go through a case with you all that Noah's going to present. And I feel like we just need to have a huge congratulations to Mark, who has a new member of the family. Mark, congratulations. I'm so happy we have another mini member of the schema team, but huge congrats to you.
Thank you so much. I'm definitely going to be asking a lot of parental advice from you, Maddie, and from any of our fans or audience, please. I'm trying to learn how to be a new dad, and it's not an easy job. It's probably the hardest job I've ever had, but it's definitely the most rewarding job. So yeah, it's been amazing.
Yeah. Sorry, Mark, don't have a schema for that.
I love that. Let's make a parenting schema.
we may have a lot of pediatric cases coming onto the Schema Series podcast very soon.
Yeah, actually, yeah. My little Aaron had some like eczema, and I'm like, should I present like an eczema case on BMR? I need a differential here. Yeah, Noah, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm super excited to present this case today. I'm in the ICU. This is a pretty serious case, and I think we're going to learn a lot. It's one of my favorite schemas, so yeah, I'm excited.
All right. Well, shall we jump into it?
All right, so this is a story of a 30-year-old woman that presented for severe midline back pain. She came to our ED because she reported onset of like this gradual lower midline back pain for the past 3 days or so. It was progressively worsening, and it was really responding to Tylenol. She was having some difficulty moving and walking around, so she decided to come in because she didn't know what else to do. She also had some mild generalized body ache, some kind of non-specific symptoms of feeling overall fatigued. And when you go talk to her, you notice that there's some stuff in her eye. And you ask her and she's like, oh yeah, my eyes have been swollen, my left eye, and some mild pain. And this all started about a week ago after a return from a trip. But really, it's not bothering me. The thing that's bothering me the most is the back pain. And I'll stop here. So, Yusuf, what do you think so far?
Thank you, Noah, for this adequate. I think usually when we think of back pain, most back pain is diagnosis that is musculoskeletal. It's somebody that sprained the muscle. And that's the vast majority of back pain that we see. But there are a couple of red flags that I usually quickly screen for to make me think of other etiologies. So one of them is the location. So usually sprains occur in the lower back, or if it is a radiculopathy, it'll be in the lower back. So if anything is in the mid back, so that's the first red flag for me. The second red flag that came up here, like systemic symptoms, this patient is returning from travel and is having this quote unquote weakness and some ocular symptoms. So this sounds like a systemic syndrome. And naturally, the first thing you think of when somebody is traveling is this an infection? And when I think of infections, when somebody is traveling, there are a few set of questions that you can use to be systematic. So you can ask, where did they go? But in addition to where they went, I would think of like, what are the activities that they did? Did they spend any time outdoors? A lot of time, our food habits change outdoors. Our food habits change abroad. So ask about food habits, ask about sexual activity, that because that can also change abroad, and delve into that, because that might help us narrow further. Now, in terms of the syndrome itself, I would love to like do an exam, see if there's actual weakness, and have to define the problem better. Maddie, what stuck out to you from the initial history?
Yeah, I love that, Yusuf. I think similar to you, when I was hearing about the back pain, I was also kind of going through if there were red flags or not. Because exactly as you said, like the vast majority of the time, it's nonspecific low back pain. But I love the points, the red flags that you pointed out, the midline back pain, the fact that this is a acute onset, kind of 3 days, and then associated with systemic symptoms is all stood out to me. I think, you know, in someone who has like mild generalized body aches, I just think of when we're in the, when we've identified red flags, we're worried about kind of beyond the base rate of nonspecific low back pain. I try to think of what are some like do not miss causes of back pain that's, you know, not in the usual location in the kind of lumbar spine. And for me, infection there really is kind of a no miss for me. So I don't want to miss a spinal epidural abscess. Don't want to miss osteomyelitis in that area. And so I think that would prompt me to ask about some questions to get at some other red flags. So has there been instrumentation in that area, for example? Had she had an injection there that could have seeded an infection? So that in my mind is one do not miss diagnosis and would probably cause me to have a low threshold to get blood cultures in this person, especially someone who has like the systemic syndrome. It's really interesting, the swelling in the eye. And I think also for me, I'm wanting to define that problem exactly. Is the whole face swollen? Is this like angioedema, or is this really just of the orbits? So I'd be very curious to, like, before going into a differential, defining that more. Mark, do you have anything else to add with this data? And maybe if anything stands out to you about the swelling of the eyes?
Yeah, I love your guys' approach to back pain. I kind of share the concerns and the red flag features. Honestly, one of the first questions I would ask this patient is like, why did you come to the ER for back pain, right? I'd be just kind of, I feel like that would give good social and contextual relevant, you know, just history for her. Because, you know, most 30-year-olds that have 3 days of back pain don't come to the ER. They either like go to an urgent care, they go to their primary care doctor, maybe they just wait it out at home. So maybe the patient's like, okay, I've had back pain before, but this is like the worst back pain I've ever had. That'd be like really helpful. So, or maybe this patient just, you know, some patients just have a very low threshold to seek care. Maybe this patient has issues with access to primary care or urgent care. And that actually would be helpful too, if this patient has not really seeked medical care and during their entire life. So that I think that would help me like frame the patient. But yeah, I think the eye symptoms are interesting, Maddie. I think like it's tough to make a differential diagnosis when I don't know the problem. And I think with the eye, everything is anatomy, right? Since like if this patient also has a red eye, we want to know, is this uveitis, scleritis, right? If it's just swelling, like is it, you know, swelling of the base of the eyelash and common things like blepharitis, right? Or is it just right around the eye? You know, no misdiagnoses. You guys talk about no misdiagnoses in the back. I would say no misdiagnoses, especially unilateral eyelid swelling. You don't want to miss preseptal or orbicularitis. Usually like, you know, allergic causes of like eye swelling. So you can think of like anaphylaxis, angioedema. That's usually like bilateral, whole face is swollen. Obviously, if you're thinking anaphylaxis, you're going to get more maybe upper respiratory symptoms, maybe GI symptoms. But those are just a kind of a quick checklist of, you know, does this patient have an infection of their eye that we need to, you know, do a good neurological exam, get a CT scan of their head to make sure they don't have orbital involvement. And then obviously screen for any signs of, you know, anaphylaxis. I think the presence of a red eye would be really helpful in this case, because red eye is kind of, you know, is a different syndrome than just eyelid swelling. So I definitely would want to know that. But yeah, just more clarity, I think, on the problem is going to be really helpful. But I can't say I've really had this like constellation of symptoms of mid. I love how Yusuf highlighted, like most people have lumbar back pain. You know, thoracic back pain, that's kind of weird, especially non-traumatic. But acute thoracic back pain and then like acute eye symptoms, can't say I've ever really thought about that problem space before. So I'm excited to learn from Noah.
All right,
You guys are asking some excellent questions. So to give a little bit more background on this patient, so she's a graduate student. She really came to the AD because the pain was kind of uncontrollable. So she came because she was like really hurting and she didn't know what to do. And in terms of the eye, so on exam, you can see that both the upper and the lower eyelid are swollen. There's some conjunctival injection and there's some yellowish discharge and it's really unilateral. There's no swelling on anywhere else in the face. In terms of her past medical history, and that's where it starts getting a little even more unusual. So she has a known diagnosis of lupus. The manifestation was lupus nephritis. She has anxiety, major depressive disorder. She has CKD as a result of the nephritis and hypertension. In terms of her meds, aspirin, Atorva, Benlysta, Wellbutrin, Jardiance, ezetimibe, hydroxychloroquine, Losartan, mycophenolate, and prednisone and trazodone. In terms of her social history, she doesn't drink, doesn't smoke, doesn't use any drugs. Like I said, she is a graduate student and she had just come back from visiting her family overseas in Asia. When you go and examine her down in the ED, she's vitally stable, afebrile, not tachycardic, normotensive, sitting well in room air. On the exam, like I said, the very notable finding is the eye finding, the left upper and left lower eyelid are swollen with some mild yellowish discharge with conjunctival injection. Lungs were clear to auscultation. Heart was regular rate, no murmurs. Belly was soft and non-tender. And you can really see that she's like in pain. She's like suffering. And she really says like, you know, my eyes are really not bothering me. I have no pain in my eyes, but my bags are really, really hurting me. You get the initial labs and, you know, the BMP is pretty unremarkable. Her creatinine is 2.1, which is relatively close to her baseline, maybe 0.2 above her baseline. And then her CBC, her Y count is 6, her hemoglobin is 12.2, her platelets are 127, which is a little bit down from her baseline, which is around 260. So I feel like I answered some of the questions you all had. I'm sure you guys have a lot more based on the exam so far and given her past medical history. Mehdi, how does that change your calculus so far?
Yeah, Noah. This is a lot of interesting data here. I think whenever someone has kind of a diagnosis of an autoimmune condition, in this case, lupus, I always like to just put a question mark in my mind of kind of how certain we are about that diagnosis. And so it sounds like this person was, the manifestation was lupus nephritis, which kind of gives me some confidence that we're kind of standing on steady ground with that diagnosis. But I think that it's always just important to kind of step back and figure out, well, what were the constellation of symptoms or what was the presentation that prompted like previous clinicians to give that patient a label of lupus? So assuming this is lupus, you know, I think when someone has an autoimmune condition, I'm asking, is this presentation completely unrelated to that? Or is it related to her autoimmune condition through either the medications that she's on that can alter the immune system or through kind of the autoimmune condition itself? So I think at this point, I'm wanting to entertain both possibilities that this could be completely unrelated, but also she with the mycophenolate that she's on, the prednisone, she does have a compromised immune system, which kind of broadens the spectrum of infections that she's at risk for getting. So I think that's how the past medical history influences this, especially with her travel history. You know, not all folks who return from abroad like have an infection, but in someone who's coming in with like an inflammatory process in their eye, atypical low back pain, I think infection is kind of the first, and then someone who is on immunocompromising medications, infection is kind of the first thing I want to rule out for her. So I would be wanting to get imaging of both the orbit of the back, get blood cultures to kind of further define the problem. Yusuf, maybe I'll pass the mic to you to hear what this data did for you.
Yeah. And Noah, before I answer, I just wanted to ask you, do we know, I had two questions. What is the dose of the prednisone and when did the symptoms start after travel or when did she return from traveling?
The prednisone dose was 5 milligrams per day. And then the symptoms started about the same day that she arrived from travel. So today, the ER presentation day is about 3 days out from the travel, and that's kind of the duration of symptoms.
Thank you, Noah. And the reason I ask is, in general, whenever I hear about immunocompromising medications, I want to know which arm of the immune system is affected. And different arms of the immune system cause different immune deficiencies, and these make you susceptible to different organisms. So if you have a T-cell deficiency, for example, think HIV, that causes intracellular infections. So that's the reason why, for example, in HIV, we worry about tuberculosis or CMV, which are intracellular, and we don't worry about mucormycosis. We worry about mucormycosis with neutrophil dysfunction, such as high doses of prednisone or DKA. So similarly, this patient, it sounds like, is on mycophenolate and steroids and a biologic agent, so a multimodal immunosuppression. And it's also important to qualify the degree of immunosuppression, so is it mild, moderate, or severe? And I think with three agents, I would say at least moderate, and I would say the arms that are affected are the T-cell and the neutrophils. So I would worry about intracellular organisms, whether viruses or bacteria. And the reason I asked about symptoms after travel is the incubation period matters. So if somebody travels and has symptoms 2 months after traveling back from Southeast Asia, most of the acute infections or the most common fever and returning traveler, which are Salmonella, malaria, and dengue, are off the table. Then you worry about things like melioidosis, which can present up to 3 months after returning from Southeast Asia, for example. So before I go through the checklist of infections, I would actually like to ask Mark what he thinks about the back pain, where is it coming from, and what he would do next.
Yeah, it's always hard to add more after your guys' brilliant discussion, but maybe I'll just kind of make a Venn diagram of SLE and back and SLE and eye, because I think that's a very interesting space. So I guess starting with the eye, I'll just say practically, let's say I'm admitting this patient to the hospital or if I'm an ER doctor, the biggest thing I'm trying to figure out is this: does this patient have preseptal cellulitis versus orbital cellulitis, right? Those are the no miss diagnoses. And there's some things you can do on exam to distinguish those two. I would say the highest yield for me is really ophthalmoplegia, right? So when you do extraocular movements, you want to see if the patient has any cranial nerve deficits. If a patient has ophthalmoplegia, then that's much more suggestive of orbital cellulitis over preseptal cellulitis, or pain with eye movements. That pain with eye movements is also suggestive of orbital cellulitis over preseptal cellulitis. Also vision changes too. I don't think we heard any vision changes, but that can also be suggestive of orbital cellulitis. So especially in this patient, I mean, Yusuf highlighted all the arms of the immune system that are down this patient. There's a very high risk that this patient does have some sort of infection in the eye, and it could, you know, be deep in their eye. So I would do those exam maneuvers, and I would get a CT or MRI of the orbits to see if there's any extension into that ocular space, because that the eye is such a small closed space that if you wait, and if even hours or a day, you know, you can that can lead to vision loss. So that's what I would do practically in the ER, and probably have a very low threshold to add, you know, antibiotics for preseptal orbital cellulitis. But that's kind of like, take a step back, right? How can SLE affect the eye? SLE can affect every single part of the eye, right? Most commonly, it actually causes like a Sjogren syndrome, like Sicca syndrome. So it just causes dry eyes. That's actually the most common ocular manifestation. But it can cause scleritis, episcleritis, rarely uveitis, retinal vasculitis, optic neuritis. Literally every single anatomical part of the eye can be affected by SLE. The other interesting thing is too, is that like hydroxychloroquine can also cause a retinopathy. And essentially all patients that get started with hydroxychloroquine with SLE will get an eye exam. I think they get an eye exam every year thereafter as well. But that's usually just a very bland retinopathy. So I think the overlap between SLE and eye is very interesting. But right now, I'm just worried about orbital cellulitis or preceptral cellulitis. That's, again, like I mentioned, that's the practical things I would do in the ER, but keeping some of these interesting manifestations in the back of my mind. And then when we think about the back, right? How can SLE affect the back? Of course, like a lupus affects your joints, right? It usually causes, you know, arthralgias, arthritis in the small joints of the hands. But, you know, you can get thoracic manifestations as well. So I think something to think about when someone's on, especially on prednisone, is that do they have a fracture, right? Do they have a vertebral compression fracture? And maybe that's totally true and unrelated to their eye manifestations that they're having. So that this is actually when an X-ray, I mean, I'll tell you why I think this patient needs advanced imaging, but an X-ray is actually really helpful for compression fracture. So that might've been done quickly in the ER and that can be quickly ruled in or ruled out. But patients on prednisone and patients with lupus are high risk for vertebral fracture. So that's one. I think Yusuf's original point about the location is very interesting because, like I said, even like epidural abscesses, discitis, osteomyelitis, we commonly see it in the lumbar region. When you start to think of thoracic region, then you can start to think about more interesting diagnoses like myelitis, right? So lupus can cause a transverse myelitis. So I'd be very curious about the patient's lower extremity neurological exam as well. And that's just something that can cause very focal back pain because it's a focal inflammatory lesion in the back. So that's, I mean, you know, you can obviously get avascular necrosis, but that's usually in the hip, but you can actually rarely get it in the spine as well. I think the last thing I'll say, and again, I just want to emphasize how immunosuppressed this patient is, right? They're on MMF, they're on PRED, they're on this other fancy biologic that I don't know what it does, but I know that the immune system is very down. This patient's at a high risk for infections in their back, right? So this patient needs an MRI of their spine. You know, you honestly, you can skip over all the other, like, you know, I told you, I mentioned why maybe an X-ray could be helpful, but this patient needs an MRI of their back to make sure they don't have an infection in their back because they're just at such a high risk. So again, I think as Maddie highlighted, like, not every time a patient comes to the hospital with an autoimmune disease, their presentation is attributable to their autoimmune disease, but it makes you broaden your differential diagnosis, not narrow it, to consider some of these interesting manifestations. But yeah, back to you, Noah. This is a fascinating case.
That was a wonderful discussion. So for some additional information, and hopefully this will kind of answer some questions and narrow the differential down quite a bit. She got imaging in the ED when she first got there. CT abdomen and pelvis without contrast showed no acute finding in the abdomen and pelvis. They did do the X-ray of the spine, which didn't show any acute finding in the spine. And she gets admitted for pain control, thought to be musculoskeletal in nature. In parallel to that, she gets started on antibiotics, and ophthalmology comes by to do an exam to, you know, evaluate for orbital versus preseptal cellulitis, like Mark was alluding to. And they weren't concerned for orbital cellulitis, but they did think that it could be preseptal cellulitis, so they agreed keeping her on antibiotics and proceeding with MRI of her orbits to further assess, you know, the extent of the infection. Kind of in parallel to that, when she gets admitted, she gets a repeat set of labs, and the CBC is quite interesting. So her platelets acutely dropped from 127, which was down from her baseline of 270, to 84. And that's like within 12 hours or so. As part of this initial workup, a ferritin gets sent somewhere for unclear reasons. And the ferritin comes back actually 29,000. An LDH also gets sent, and the LDH is 4,000. The sample was hemolyzed, so it may be falsely elevated, but that's the result that we have. With that in mind, that was like a big pivot point of this case because it's kind of a nebulous situation, but the ferritin being so high, I feel like there's no way that we can move forward without fully explaining this lab. So, Mark, maybe I can turn it back to you and we can maybe step away from this case for a sec and just kind of walk me through how you think about like those states where the ferritin is super high, like ultra hyperferritinemia.
Yeah, this case took quite the turn. Honestly, in like situations like this, I kind of like take a deep breath and I'm like, oh, wow, thank goodness I have a lab that has such a short differential diagnosis, right? Like they're, like you said, this must be explained. And the differential diagnosis for a ferritin of 29,000 and LDH of 4,000 is like four things, right? I mean, I should say like four buckets of things. I kind of just made up that number, but it's a very short list. But yeah, I guess when I you know, approach ferritin in general, I think the first question I'm asking, right, ferritin is an acute phase reaction, right? And when you're approaching a case of hyperferritinemia, the question is this an inflammatory state or is this iron overload, right? Because ferritin can be elevated as acute phase reactant in acute and chronic inflammatory states, and then also in patients with iron overload. Like classically, you think of a patient with hemochromatosis, right, that has a high ferritin, has a high transferrin set. Now, the patients that have hyperferritinemia from inflammatory states have inflammatory symptoms and are usually pretty sick, right? Like this patient's pretty sick. This patient has a disease that's also associated, inflammatory disease that's associated with hyperferritinemia, so probably associated with that bucket. The patients that have iron overload aren't inflamed, are usually not that acutely sick. And though another way to tease out those two as well is a transferrin saturation. Patients with iron overload usually have a very, very high transferrin saturation. So that's kind of my approach of like, ferritin's elevated, is it inflammatory, is it iron overload? Now, ultra hyperferritinemia, there's some studies that show that like a ferritin over like 20,000 is essentially HLH, cytokine release syndrome, or any like heavy inflammatory condition of the liver, right? Because the liver stores ferritin. So I've seen patients with shock liver have ferritins through the roof, and we're like, oh, do they have HLH? And it's usually they don't. It's just that all that ferritin that's stored in the liver is getting released in the bloodstream. So that's kind of like the three big things. Now, the diagnosis of HLH is really complicated. I'm sure we'll talk about that at some point. SLE is associated with HLH, or when we say that when autoimmune diseases are triggering HLH syndrome, we call it macrophage activation syndrome, or MAS. The diagnosis is very tricky. And then also you always want to look for a trigger, right? Now, SLE is a trigger, but SLE is also associated with a bunch of the other triggers of HLH, which maybe we'll get into. But that's my kind of like big bucket approach. Maybe I'll leave the LDH also, because I have some thoughts about the interplay of this ferritin and the LDH, but maybe I'll kick it to Yusuf to see what other thoughts he has.
Yeah, similar to you, Mark. Whenever I see ferritin this high, I think I initially want to rule out HLH. And HLH is often not an endpoint diagnosis. Similar to leukocytosis, or neutrophilia, or lymphocytosis, HLH is sort of a flavor of inflammation. And whenever you see that flavor of inflammation, it points you to a subset of diagnoses that may cause HLH. So like Mark said, I want to confirm that that's going on. So I want to confirm that there is hemolysis and confirm check the triglyceride level, for example, and open the H-score and calculate this patient's H-score. And then remember that the HLH is not a terminal diagnosis. And then I start thinking about what are the secondary causes of HLH. So what happens is often an intracellular organism, for example, is inside an antigen-presenting cell, and it causes a dysregulated cascade of inflammation. And this causes hemolysis. So the organisms that are intracellular include granulomatous infections. So think things like tuberculosis, for example, intracellular organisms of the gut. So think of salmonella, intracellular organisms of the lungs, like mycoplasma, for example. And then a lot of the typhoidal organisms can also cause this. So the list is on and on and on, and many of the tick-borne illnesses also cause it. The other categories that are non-infectious include lymphoma, and the big autoimmune category is SLE. And of course, I didn't mention things like EBV, and there are substances that can also cause this, including one of the ingredients of tonic, which is very like interesting, quinine. So what would I do next? I think I would at least get a triglyceride level. A clue, for example, can be leukopenia. That can be a clue to HLH. I would ask for a smear. And then once the diagnosis is confirmed, who would you call next? And oftentimes, if you do call hematology, they are going to tell you like, hey, even though this is HLH, we want to rule out secondary HLH first before we consider this primary HLH. Because if this is primary HLH, which is often like genetic, the treatment is massive immunosuppression. So I think the first step is confirm HLH, rule out very common infections and SLE malignancy, and then move on to primary HLH. Maddie, any thoughts?
That was a absolutely brilliant breakdown from you and Mark, but I don't have anything to add. I think I'm exactly with you right now. I want to send the additional studies through the H-score to evaluate if this is HLH and then go search for secondary causes.
Can I mention one more thing? Because I'm so excited about this case. And I think it's a fascinating, the labs of the ferritin and the LDH in combination. The LDH of 4000 also has just as narrow of a differential diagnosis as HLH. And honestly, I think an LDH of 4000 cannot really solely be explained by HLH. I mean, maybe there's something that literature out there that I'm not familiar with, but that just sounds even too high just for LDH. When you have an LDH in the 1000s, actually hemolysis starts to be less likely. Usually, hemolysis usually tends to cause LDHs less than 1000. So a few things that I think of when I think of an LDH in the 1000s are ischemia of some organ. So I'd be very curious about the liver. Right? I talked about the how ferritin is stored in the liver. So shock liver, I know this patient's not in shock, but I've seen shock liver cause like LDHs of 4,000 and ferritin's like a 29,000. So ischemia of some organ, right? That could be really any organ, leads to cell death and a really high LDH. And then breakdown of premature hematopoietic cells. So the concept of like ineffective erythropoiesis from any cause, right? Classically, we can think of this of like thalassemia, right? When red blood cells get destroyed in the bone marrow, those premature cells actually have more LDH than mature cells, and they cause sky high LDHs. Same thing with a vitamin B12 deficiency, right? Vitamin B12 deficiency is a classic mimicker of like TTP because it leads to ineffective erythropoiesis and destruction of cells in the marrow and really, really high LDHs. So I'm very curious, like, is there some sort of destruction of premature cells? And obviously that can happen in HLH, but there's something that's rubbing me the wrong way about this LDH of 4000. And the last thing I'll mention is it would be a very kind of rare way to put the back pain together, but bone marrow necrosis, I think would be an interesting cause of like the thoracic back pain, because ferritin is also stored in the bone marrow. And you can get massive LDH elevation from like bone marrow necrosis. And, maybe if it's relevant, we can talk about the differential diagnosis for bone marrow necrosis. But I think the differential diagnosis of just this ferritin 29,000 LDH of 4,000 is just super small and very interesting. So excited to learn more from Noah. Sorry that I just keep rambling.
Mark, 30 minutes of discussion and we still haven't mentioned Still's disease. So I'm impressed by us. So I think we just want more history first.
Yeah, that was a wonderful discussion. It's really impressive how quickly this case kind of ramps up from here. So this was in the morning, and then by mid-afternoon, the patient's like not looking good, right? You go there, she's groaning in pain, she's kind of getting altered. You repeat some labs, and her liver enzymes, which were initially completely normal, now AST, ALT are 700, 400. You repeat the labs again, and next time you check, it's like 1,200 and 900. Her hemoglobin is like quickly falling. Other hemolysis markers are actually negative, and her platelets are also downtrending, 29, 23, 21. So given the concern for, this multi-organ system failure, she gets transferred to the ICU. On ICU admission, she was a pretty hard stick for IV access. So they place an A-line, and they try to place an ultrasound-guided IV on her arm. And she actually develops like significant hematomas in both arms. She has to get decompressions by plastic surgery in bilateral arms. When you look at her, she's, a young woman, groaning in pain, really not communicative, kind of altered. And looking at her, she has this swelling in her left eye, and then she has kind of like a rash throughout her face and her upper back, which the way I would describe it is maybe some vesicles on a background of like this patchy erythematous rash. She obviously looks very ill and she quickly develops shock. Her labs, the renal function remains stable. The liver function continues to worsen in a hepatocellular pattern. So AST, ALT go as high as 4,000 and then 2,000. Her LDH is repeated and is still around 4,000. She's considered to be too unstable to go for further imaging. Ferritin continues to uptrend to 34,000. Triglycerides, which Yusuf asked for, I think were 258. So I've deliberately been withholding some of the more specific workup because I think that it's interesting for us to kind of think about what we would order in terms of the workup for this ultra hyperferritinemia in those situations. So I'm kind of opening to you all. Maybe we can start with you, Maddie. Like, is there any specific workup in terms of like infectious diseases or like autoimmune etiologies or maybe malignant etiologies that you would be ordering for this patient if they are coming to your ICU?
Yeah, well, clearly this person is so sick, and I am happy that I would, if I were actually in this situation, I would be leaning on so many colleagues and other specialists to kind of help figure out what is the best care for this person. I think the workup is really anchored in what Yusuf and Mark taught us in terms of when you have a concern for HLH, and Yusuf, you know, you can pull up the H score and there are things like cytopenias, splenomegaly, triglycerides that kind of help increase your suspicion for it. And really, it's classified as primary HLH versus secondary HLH. And so you really want to, the secondary causes, as Yusuf and Mark went over, include infections, autoimmune diseases, and cancer, like lymphomas. And so I think how that my workup would be looking would be targeted towards understanding those secondary causes. So for the infection, blood cultures, peripheral smear, HIV, EBV, CMV, especially with the vesicles on that rash, like could that be zoster is kind of the first thought that went through my mind. For autoimmune, you know, it's, you know, lupus can be like an autoimmune trigger for HLH, but you don't want to just anchor on that and miss an additional trigger. But are there labs that you could send that would help us see if lupus is related to this? I'm not sure, but that's a gap in my knowledge. And then for the question of, you know, lymphoma, I think the smear will help us. Does this patient need a bone marrow biopsy? I'm not sure. I think I'm like at my at the limits of my knowledge here, but really would just be going through the secondary causes and wanting to rule out infections first before we need to think about even further immunosuppressing this person. Yusuf, what are your thoughts? What would you do practically in this case?
Yeah, I think it's a tough case because I don't even know if I want to label it as HLH. Like Mark was saying, with the possibility of like shock liver, the AST of 700, an ALT close to that number, I worry that this patient may be having multi-organ failure. And that's secondary to some etiology that we need to find out. And I think if I'm thinking about this like fever in a returning traveler, even though we don't have a fever, we have like a ferritin of multi-organ failure. So I think it's okay, it's safe to like rule out an infection. From Southeast Asia with an incubation period of 1 day with a significant component of thrombocytopenia. And I think I would approach it like that, at least in the first day or two. And because that would be the initial workup before I can broaden my workup. So I think my day one, day two workup is to rule out arboviruses. So I'm thinking things like dengue fever or Japanese encephalitis. We don't hear about like encephalitic symptoms here. Other things that are in Southeast Asia include like typhus. So like scrub typhus or murine typhus. Salmonella, like we said earlier, like salmonella, malaria, dengue should be your first three in any returning traveler. I think these will be like options A, B, and C, like for the workup. This patient will be on doxy stat and send this workup and support this patient with broad spectrum antibiotics, pressors as needed as this workup like runs. I'm not sure I would do a lot differently in the first day or two, but other than do that and get detailed imaging, I think that would be helpful. Like, is there a lung infiltrate? Are there lung nodules? Is there anything else any like other fingerprint that we can see anywhere else, and then maybe see if I can get like a specific history or that will point me to any specific diagnosis. Mark, what are you thinking?
Yeah, I totally agree. I think the priority is definitely looking for infectious triggers of HLH first. And I agree with you. I hate the H score because it's so nonspecific. And like, if you calculated H score and like every patient in multi-organ failure in the ICU, like everyone's going to be triggering for HLH. But you know, it's like, it's a sensitive test, right? You don't want to miss HLH. So it makes sense. And the issue is like the specific tests that are a little more specific for HLH takes so long to come back. So like the NK cell activity, the soluble IL-2 receptor, the CXCL9, like all those like cytokine type of tests like take a week or weeks to come back. So the rest is just like non-specific labs that like every patient in the ICU has, you know, derangements in. So I definitely like, I agree with not labeling this as HLH, and like I'm personally a splitter, and I think that's kind of what Eustace is doing. He's like, oh, thrombocytopenia, I'm thinking about arboviruses, like not losing track of all this abnormalities to like really help you like solve this problem, I think is very important. I don't think we've mentioned this yet, but I just want to highlight the base rate of infections in HLH, right? It's the herpes viruses. Maddie alluded to, like, it's the herpes virus. EBV, by far the most common cause of infectious trigger of HLH, right? I think it's almost like 50% of infectious HLH is from EBV. And there's kind of different flavors of it. Like there's kind of the primary EBV infection that especially younger adults get and that can trigger HLH. And then there's the EBV infection that immunosuppressed patients can get. Usually that's a reactivation or this very like interesting, like not well understood entity of chronic active EBV infection that can trigger HLH. So I'd definitely be sending our EBV PCR, which is a super hard to interpret in the ICU. So that definitely would be leaning on our infectious disease colleagues too to help with that interpretation. But I'm sending all of my herpes virus serologies and PCRs, right? Maddie mentioned like this sounds, you know, vesicular rash on erythematous base. Could this be disseminated VZV in an immunosuppressed patient causing a terrible liver injury, causing, you know, cytopenias? It definitely could. Sending all my herpes viruses, serologies and PCR. So that's the viral. The one I want to mention, or two I want to mention that I don't think we mentioned yet, the time course doesn't really fit well for them, but leishmaniasis is one of these like subacute to chronic triggers of HLH. Now this patient went from like 0 to 100 and is now in the ICU, so probably less likely, but it's something to think about in someone that that had recent travel. And then histoplasmosis is by far the most common fungal trigger of HLH, so I definitely would send histoplasmosis urine antigen and serologies and serum antigens as well. And then, yeah, like I mentioned, like not losing sight of all these abnormalities and not labeling this as HLH yet, because I thought, you know, is there a chance, right? This patient has SLE, they're having progressive thrombocytopenia. We have to make sure this patient doesn't have a TMA, right? Because you can imagine, like, what if this patient has a TMA, right? And they just have ischemic injury to a bunch of organs, right? They have ischemic injury to their liver and it's leading to a crazy high ferritin, crazy high LDH, right? So I think, you know, we don't have, it seems like, schistocytes on the smear and our hemolysis labs are negative, but any SLE patient with like progressive thrombocytopenia, I'm like probably repeating those hemolysis labs and smears daily. Now you have to be careful with the haptoglobin when the liver's not doing well, because the haptoglobin can just start to, you know, downtrend when the liver's not producing haptoglobin. But yeah, this patient is so sick and I just want to make sure that we keep a close eye on all those abnormalities and not label this as HLH yet, but do the appropriate workup.
Thank you, Mark. And I think one thing that I wanted to point out also to the people listening is that this discussion also mostly applies for very high ferritins of like higher than like 10K. And the lower the ferritin, the less specific it gets.
Wonderful, wonderful discussion. So what I'm hearing is that three main buckets: malignancy, autoimmune, infectious, and then we kind of like are using the demographics and the base rate to guide our workup in our differential diagnosis. So she did get a bone marrow biopsy with flow. There was no evidence of malignancy. She did get the lupus activity markers like the double-stranded DNA and the complement levels, which were actually at her baseline. And her UA was never active. Her creatinine never worsened. And she was pretty, pretty adherent to her lupus therapies. And the rheumatology team was consulted and it felt pretty strongly that the lupus was quiescent. And if anything, that would make her more at risk for an infectious trigger. I think that the workup that you guys are suggesting is so interesting. And I actually sometimes have a lot of difficulty trying to understand how we should investigate all those different etiologies, right? Like I know how to, how to check for HIV, right? You send the HIV test, but like, how would I check for scrub typhus? That I don't know. So for the things that I do know how to send, and I know that they did send, fungal workup was all negative. So they sent histo, blasto, cocci, crypto. Those were all negative. Bacterial workup, so blood cultures were no growth. Urine culture didn't grow anything. They didn't find any other source of obvious infection. And then I think one thing that you guys have been mentioning, which I think is very important in a case like this, is like, okay, I have multi-organ failure, but what needs to be accounted for, right? Let's go back and let's kind of think about the things that I can attribute to like an underlying process versus the things that I cannot. And in this lady, it's very hard because she's obviously very sick, and very sick people, like all those disease processes, they kind of go hand in hand, right? Is the liver failure from the HLH, or is the ferritin from the liver failure? Are her platelets kind of falling because, she's not producing, or are they being destroyed in the periphery because she's so sick? So I think that's kind of like in my head, this was all kind of related. I didn't know what was the chicken or the egg, but they were kind of all related. The one thing that was really hard to explain though was the eye findings and this weird vesicular rash, right? If you guys go back, this was like the first initial complaint. She had this eye findings for about 7 days. And even though it wasn't really bothering her, it was definitely very altered on the ophthalmology exam. And they were very concerned for preceptocellulitis. They even wanted like the orbit MRI, which kind of fell to the wayside when she got very sick. So the ICU team actually swapped those lesions and they came back positive for both VZV and HSV. Simultaneously, they had sent the HSV and VZV and CMV and EBV PCR in the blood. And she came back positive for CMV, VZV, and HSV PCR in the blood. EBV in her case was negative. So Maddie, you had mentioned those etiologies. What do you think about the workup so far? How can I interpret? I know Mark said that EBV is kind of hard to interpret in the ICU. What do you think about the other tests?
I think in someone who's so sick who we don't have another etiology, I think I'm pinning these herpes viruses as the causative agents causing this horrible inflammation. I've learned that specifically CMV, you need basically tissue. You need to see the CMV in the tissue to kind of pin the CMV as the causative agent. But I think in this person who has multiple herpes viruses in their blood, till we hear something else, it seems like a reasonable hypothesis that the liver failure, the systemic hyperinflammatory syndrome is like that. That could be kind of like the secondary cause of this hyperinflammatory syndrome. Mark, what do you think?
I totally agree with you, Manny. I think the issue is where we run into trouble with these PCRs and serologies is that we order them when the syndrome does not fit. And that's the issue. It's like we have a patient that the syndrome doesn't fit for a CMV syndrome, a VZV syndrome, an HSV syndrome. Maybe we get it for like nonspecific fever and like an immunocompromised host or some other reason. And it comes back low level positive and we're kind of like, I don't really know what to do. Right. And then we talk to ID, they yell at us, they say, please stop ordering those because we're getting so many consults for these. But in this patient, the syndrome fits, right? VZV and CMV are essentially the second and third most common viral trigger of HLH. So that makes sense. I'd be curious like how high they are. I know at least for EBV and I think CMV, like there is some data that shows like the height of the PCR maybe correlates to disease, but I don't think like in practice, like infectious disease doctors use that too much. I think, again, they're kind of like, does this syndrome fit? And like for someone that's not that sick, it's like, does this patient have like, fever, adenopathy, cytopenias, fatigue, you know, things that fit with like a, you know, CMV syndrome. But, you know, if I was on an island, I would start treatment for VZV and CMV 100% because this patient's too sick. The risks are pretty low. And honestly, we have a pretty, at least for VZV, we have a pretty decent syndrome, right? We have a vesicular rash. VZV can affect the eye. You know, VZV also is one of the most common infectious causes of transverse myelitis, right? I'm still kind of curious, like, why does this patient have terrible back pain? Maybe it didn't, Noah mentioned a data point that explained that because we've had so much data, I'm kind of losing track of things. But like, this patient came to the hospital because they had like intractable back pain, and we still don't really know why they had back pain. So like, maybe this patient has VZV transverse myelitis too. Again, not really any neurological symptoms, but patient's also probably like in an ICU bed, not moving too much. So it's probably tough to assess that. But yeah, I would certainly treat this patient for like, you know, all these herpes viruses and see if it, you know, if it helps. You know, obviously like these viruses also we order for liver injury, like an acute liver injury, especially when it's rather high and we don't have a great reason. Now, as Noah mentioned, the liver injury could just be from, you know, HLH, you know, affects the liver commonly, but, you know, could this be a VZV or a CMV and HSV hepatitis, right? Especially HSV in immunocompromised host causes a terrible hepatitis. So I think they're very relevant here. I think, you know, the infectious disease colleges would be interested in these. But yeah, what do you think, Yusuf?
I think a very like difficult case, and you definitely need like transplant ID on board. But I agree with Mark. The syndrome fits. It's hyperacute after the vesicle started with now like multi-organ failure. I think thinking about management reasoning, like Mark is saying, what can we do next? We are lucky that we have antiviral agents that would treat all of the above, including like VZV, HSV, and CMV. So something like ganciclovir plus minus acyclovir, which would be started by ID, obviously, especially that I agree with the syndrome fitting and the steroid patient who's like significantly immunocompromised. Like we said earlier at the beginning, in the T cell domain, so would be really susceptible to intracellular infections like viruses. And continue broad spectrum antibiotics. And the question is, how are these symptoms getting? Like, why is she having back pain? I wonder if there's like some form of vasculopathy associated with these viruses, because these viruses can cause a vasculitis like picture with which can affect multiple organs and cause multi organ failure.
Yusuf, I think one of the toughest management reasoning decisions too will be from the oncologist and whether to give this patient chemotherapy. You know, there's a pretty strong indication in like primary HLH to give, you know, chemotherapy. I've seen, I think there's multiple regimens, but I've seen in practice like etoposide is one of the go-to for HLH. And then I know the data is kind of mixed for especially like viral associated HLH, especially for something like EBV where we don't have great antivirals. I think some like oncologists might, you know, give like, you know, chemotherapy to help with the HLH physiology. So I think that also would be is going to be a really tough decision for them to make too. Maybe in this circumstance, like you said, because we have, you know, good antivirals for these specific viruses, that maybe you would try that first. But I know that's something that's always in the back of their minds.
All right, that was a beautiful discussion. So back to the patient. She unfortunately did not do very well. I hear you, Yusuf and Mark. I don't know why she had back pain. This was never truly figured out. She, you know, became more and more altered. She was ultimately intubated. Her creatinine did worsen after that, after she had worsening shock. And then she had a pretty severe kind of DIC picture, bleeding from her lines, bleeding from her ET tube. She was managed with pretty broad antimicrobial therapy with IV acyclovir, doxycycline, meropenem, ganciclovir. She was treated with steroids. She also was started on anakinra, specifically for the HLH, based on discussions between rheumatology, hematology, and the primary team. They felt her state was so tenuous that she wouldn't tolerate like etoposide. Ultimately, given the DIC physiology and kind of unable to keep up with transfusion requirements, she ended up the family ended up electing to transition her to comfort care, and she ended up passing away. So very sad story, a pretty young patient that kind of like all of a sudden came crashing down. So this is kind of the conclusion of the case. The thought was that she didn't have either HSV or VZV or both, kind of as the primary trigger. She didn't have CMV viremia in the past, and the team felt that this was more likely to represent reactivation in the setting of this, you know, critical illness, like you were alluding to earlier. And then, yeah, so this is her story. Any reflections on the case? Maybe we can start with you, Maddie.
Noah, thank you for presenting this case. And I'm so sorry to hear about the patient's outcome. I really do think that by sharing cases like this, it's a way to honor the patient's story and for us and all the people who are listening to this to learn more and kind of help the patients that we care for. It was clearly such a complicated case, and it was challenging to figure out what was the chicken or the egg, right? Like, so the liver enzymes in the thousands, was that from viral hepatitis, or was that from HLH, or was that from shock liver? And so, or all, you know, a combination of all of those things. But I think, and I'm also just humbled by how much havoc these herpes viruses can wreck. So yeah, Yusuf, what are your reflections on this?
Yeah, I just think it's like a devastating case. Thank you for sharing, Noah. It definitely helped me learn about iron overload and ferritin, thinking about the difference between the two and thinking about this specific flavor of inflammation, which is HLH, and the mimics of it. So thank you for sharing the case. Mark, any reflections?
Yeah, thank you just for honoring her and allowing us to like learn from her story. I had a very similar case my last year of residency, patient in their 30s that I was just covering for a colleague for one day in the ICU, and we admitted her with new HLH, and she passed away within like 5 hours of being in the ICU. It's a just devastating disease, and I think we just have so much more to learn about HLH, and you know, new and so many more therapies that hopefully can, you know, come through the pipeline soon. But yeah, thanks Noah, thanks for sharing.
Yeah, thank you all for discussing. I think some diagnostic reasoning pearls that I can extract from this case, or this case kind of helped further solidify them in my mind. I think the first one is when the picture is like very broad and very murky, just kind of going back to what we need to explain, right? So in the very beginning, she had the eye findings, she had the back findings, and then she had the ferritin. We need to explain the ferritin. And then whenever she was sicker in the ICU, maybe we didn't have to explain the liver enzymes. We could kind of attribute that to the multi-organ failure, but we did have to explain the rash and the eye findings, which would be kind of unusual in other forms of HLH. And then the other diagnostic reasoning pearl that came from this is like, whenever someone has kind of distant organ manifestations, kind of think about what's connecting them. So when I first heard the story and she had the eye findings and the back findings, my mind kind of went to the blood as a way to connect those two, because they're pretty far apart. So given the history of the Asia travel, I was thinking maybe like the hypervirulent Klebsiella infection as a way to explain the distant findings. And then ferritin kind of emerges as a marker of autoinflammation, which it's a relatively cheap test. You can always send it. And it may surprise you, just like this case, the ferritin was much higher in the beginning, way before any of the other laboratory and like clinical manifestations came to be. So I think the power of the ferritin and then kind of the power of trying to explain those pivot points.
Yeah, I love that. Thank you so much, Noah, for bringing this case. And Yusuf and Mark, as always, so happy you were here to kind of talk through this really challenging case. But it was a blast, as always.
Likewise, Maddie, likewise.
That's a wrap, everyone. Thanks for tuning in.
If you enjoyed this episode and want to be part of our community, join us for our live virtual morning report, where you can present the case or discuss with us. Visit our website for details. We would love to have you.